From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. This week, we visit the world of low-tech photography and bring it up to date. A lot of us still have a treasure trove of old photos, negatives, slides, stuffed in shoeboxes or in albums in a basement or a closet. Now there are companies that will scan them into digital form, though often at a hefty price. NPR's Laura Seidel has a profile of one company that's managed to make preserving those old memories a more affordable proposition.
How many pictures are in shoeboxes? Sam Allen, CEO of Scan Cafe, actually commissioned a study to find out.
In the U.S., right now, there are about 550 billion analog photographs.
That's 550 billion. That's a lot of photos. Allen says most people don't realize that they're taking a risk by letting them sit around.
These images are dying every day, and they die a little bit more, and they fade away, and people don't understand that.
For less than $300, anyone can buy a scanner. But to scan all those photos, Allen tries to do the math.
And so if you want to scan, 1,000 photographs at 4 minutes per scan time, plus another five in post-scan processing, you're talking thousands of minutes of your time.
And there's where he saw a business opportunity. People send their photos to Scan Cafe and pay the company to put them in digital form. And it will also Photoshop out the flaws. The company's Wade Legrone holds up a photo of a customer's grandfather back in Eastern Europe. Judging by his black hat and long side locks, he's a Jew. But it's hard to see the details of his features because of cracks and fading in the picture.
There's a massive amount of dust and noise and tiny little scratches that make it look as if this photo were taken in a snowstorm.
Legrone then shows me what the same photo looks like after their technicians process it. It looks great.
Now that photograph, if you've gotten it, you would never know it ever been damaged.
Damaged old pictures were on Chrissy Knudsen's mind last year when she realized that her family photos were at risk. Her mother was asked to evacuate her house during last year's fires in Southern California.
I said, Mom, just please don't lose these pictures.
Knudsen's mother put them in storage.
So they're just in these boxes and albums and loose and all this stuff. So I'm taking like kind of a box at a time every time I see her.
Knudsen has been taking them, sorting them, and sending them to Scan Cafe. Each photo and color negative cost 29 cents a piece. That's nearly half the price of the largest competitor, Scan Digital. The catch is Knudsen has to send all her photos to the Scan Cafe plant in Bangalore, India, and it can take as long as 6 weeks before she sees them again. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
And to talk about how you can better preserve your personal photo archive, we're joined now, as we are most Mondays, by Omar Gallego, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. Welcome, Omar.
Hi, Robert. Good to be here.
And we heard in Laura's piece about the pricing for Scan Cafe services, 29 cents a piece. I imagine that's why they're scanning in Bangalore?
Yeah, I actually spoke to Sam Allen, the CEO of the company, previously, and he told me that he believes Scan Cafe has the largest scanning facility in the world with hundreds of workers trained in photo restoration and scanning.
But is this really such a labor-intensive proposition that you have to seek out a cheaper labor market to do it?
For basic scanning, it's something most people can handle on their own, but the very deep photo restoration that they talk about in the piece, most people wouldn't know how to do that, even if they had a copy of Photoshop. And it's so complex that a lot of it requires really a human touch. There is software that can do some auto-correction to photos, but for the real fine-tuning, for fixing a tear in a photo or the kind of snow that we talked about in the picture, mm-hmm. you really need to have some skills to be able to do that. It's very complicated.
Well, for people who own such photos and balk at the notion of sending them off to Bangalore for a month and a half, are there any scanners available that are faster than the traditional flatbed ones that some people already have?
Yeah, there is a category of scanner called a sheet-fed scanner that can handle multiple documents at once. They're usually a little bit more expensive than flatbed scanners, and you still have to process the photos. You still have to bring them into the software and save the file and set the size and all that. But for very fragile photos, like I said, you'd really want to be careful about running them through any kind of sheet feeder. I mean, it's a really good way to destroy a photo and tear it even further if it's something that's very old and fragile.
I mean, one of the reasons that we would want to do this to our old photos is the fear that they'll continue to fade and eventually we might not be able to see anything on the pictures. So let's say they're turned into digital files. Are they permanently restored? Where do they reside once they're digital files?
Well, anyone that's ever had a hard drive crash knows that digital data is definitely not permanent or safe unless you take precautions. I mean, backing up all those important documents to an external hard drive, that's become pretty commonplace. We see a lot of that now. But there are a lot of devices from flash drives to off-site storage services that are other alternatives. The real big issue that I've found that people are worried about now is what happens if there's a fire or flood or theft. You know, you lose your data even if you have it protected somewhere in your home. In my home, I actually use what's called a Drobo, which is short for data robotics. It's a small black box that contains multiple hard drives. So if one hard drive goes bad, you still have the data intact. Everything is still there. You just swap out the drive and you're good to go. But like I said, that doesn't help you if you have a fire, flood, or theft. So offsite services are becoming more and more popular. That stuff lives on the cloud. You can access it from anywhere, and you have the security of letting someone else manage your data instead of having it be in danger in your home.
Omar, so far we've been talking about old photos. What about old videos or old 16mm films or old Super 8 films for that matter?
Well, there are a lot of gadgets and software to transfer your old movies to your computer, a lot of them for under $50. The problem is with a lot of the older devices, a lot of the 16mm and Hi8, it may not have the right kind of connection to interface with those devices and plug into your computer. But if you do have, say, VHS or Beta or something that does connect, once you've got those digital files, there are online services that allow you to share those files or even edit your videos online. One just debuted this month. It's called Pixorial.com, and it features online editing of your digital videos and the ability to get those videos burned to a DVD or to share them online with family and friends. Now, if you don't have the tools to interface with your computer, they will actually do it for you. You can just mail in your tapes or film strips, and they will digitize them. They'll be available online for you to edit and watch or share with friends. We will actually be linking to Pixorial.com and a lot of the other resources we've been talking about on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
And while we are on the subject of npr.org, we'd like to announce the opening of our first ever All Tech Considered Photography exhibition, featuring the work of none other than you, our listeners. We asked you to send us your favorite summer images, and over the past 2 months, we've received hundreds of submissions. Our multimedia team has compiled some of these images into a very impressive gallery, and we invite you to visit and peruse. Thanks to all of you who sent us your photographs. It's all at the new NPR.org. Thank you, Omar.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And you've surely noticed how many things in the digital world are free. Search engines, games, news. Today, we continue to look at the ways in which free is changing how companies do business. Consumers love a price of zero, and many come to expect it. For businesses, though, that can be tough on the bottom line. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports on two companies with two different approaches.
Seattle-based Big Fish Games is indeed a big fish in its industry. It distributes more online games than anyone else, about 1 million a day. Company founder Paul Phelan says the company's approach to customers is based on a very simple idea.
We call it try before you buy.
You can try almost any Big Fish game for free, and many remain free forever. Phelan says games like Bubbles open in an internet browser, and you can play as often as you like.
You can hear the bubble popping sound. We're shooting little round paint bubbles at other little round paint bubbles and trying to match colors. This game probably costs the developer somewhere between $5,000 and $20,000 to build, and it can be supported by ads, and it is.
Its large audience brings in advertisers, and those ad dollars cover the cost. But ads alone won't pay for cinematic and highly produced games like Drawn the Painted Tower.
In a world shrouded in darkness, in a town bleak and trampled,
the game costs more than $1 million to create, and the audience is limited, so you have to pay to play. Or take another game, Faunasphere. You can play for free, but there are add-ons. Things like extra animals make the game more fun, but you have to pay for them. This approach to pricing is called freemium. Some content is free, premium content is not. At some companies, a small number of paying customers essentially subsidize the free riders. At Big Fish, the model is more complicated, but it works. The company has grown from one employee to 400 in the past 7 years. 3,000 miles away in New York City, Dane Atkinson favors a more old-school approach. Atkinson is CEO of a company called Squarespace.
It's a publishing platform on the internet that thankfully charges all of its customers.
That's right. Squarespace is proud to charge businesses, bloggers, and others for publishing tools to create websites, even though there are companies providing similar services for free.
We began with a free model. Anthony, who's a founder, was under a lot of pressure from the community at the time to say that everything has to be free. And he quickly realized that it just seemed like the wrong equation. So he started charging. And what it's allowed us to do is really build a model that caters to those customers and not feel any of the pressures that the free business model puts against you.
They don't have to worry about or appease advertisers who are footing the bill. Because customers at Squarespace pay a monthly fee for hosting and other services, the company can provide customer support 24 hours a day. Free sites supported by ad revenue can't afford to do that. Atkinson says privately held Squarespace is very successful, but he says some so-called experts still prod them to offer a free service.
And we know the reason we're succeeding is because we don't. So every time a book comes out or people expound on how free is the only way to go, it gets our hairs standing up. There is another way to run your business.
Running a digital business is tricky, and finding that sweet spot between free, freemium, and paid may be the difference between success and failure. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about free and the music industry.
In a new study, the American Heart Association suggests strictly limiting your sugar intake. Can you live on 6 to 9 teaspoons of the sweet stuff a day? Or how about eliminating sugar from your diet entirely? We put the question to our friends on Facebook, and here's what some of them had to say.
I don't drink coffee. I don't smoke. I don't do some other things. So I feel like I need my chocolate and desserts. I do stick to natural stuff like agave, honey, or raw sugar when I do add sugar. My name is Aggie. Thanks a lot.
I'm still trying to kick the habit, and that people don't believe it's a drug, but you feel so much better when you haven't had it for a while. So that's my take on things, and my name is Olu.
My name is Mona. I live in Long Beach, California. You know, my story isn't going to sound too interesting about just like how I've never particularly liked sugar, but I did, as a woman, notice a serious difference. And when I eliminated sugar around my monthly cycle, there's a lot of information I realized.
Hi, this is Jill from Michigan. I'm not going to totally rule out sugar, but I am drinking more water now and walk to my walking DVD. I'm not much of a sweet eater, but I do have to have my pasta. I must be doing something right because my weight has been stable over the past 5 years. Everything in moderation.
Aggie, Olu, Mona, and Jill reached out to us through Facebook. If you're logged on, you can become friends with Michelle Martin, too. And who knows, you might hear yourself on the radio. Go to see when sun goes down.
You know, it's been almost 10 years now since Napster turned the music industry on its head. The file-sharing service allowed fans to freely exchange music on the Internet. And since then, CD sales, along with record company profits, have plummeted. This morning, we're going to wrap up our series on the free world on the Internet with this report from NPR's Laura Seidel.
The music industry has been taken down by free. Check this out. In 2000, NSYNC's No Strings Attached was top of the Billboard charts. If you want it, here's my heart. No strings attached. The group sold nearly 2.5 million CDs in 1 week. Last year, it took only 1 million CDs for Lil Wayne's album to reach the top of the charts. We are not the same, I am a Martian, and I'm hotter than summer rain like all Thomas. Music industry revenues have dropped by half since Napster came to the scene. Attorney Don Passman, who's represented major recording artists such as Janet Jackson and R.E.M., says even fans of the biggest stars aren't paying for music.
You can't compete with free. It's very difficult to sell a product if everyone can get it for free.
But Passman thinks if fans keep this up, the quality of music is going down because no one will be able to make a living as a professional musician. In this era of the internet revolution, Passman looks back to a different revolution, the French one.
They not only lopped off the heads of Louis and Marie Antoinette, they also did away with the copyright law.
For several years, the French could get books for almost nothing, and authors had a hard time making a living.
And what happened is that 3 years later, the French government reinstated the copyright law because they realized that for artists to be able to survive, they have to be able to make a living from their work.
Today in the United States, we have copyright laws. They've just become more difficult for the record labels to enforce. Over the last decade, the recording industry has filed thousands of suits against alleged file shares. Most of them settled out of court. Sure, iTunes sold 2 billion songs last year, but compare that to the 15 billion songs that are downloaded illegally every year, according to the research firm Big Champagne. Chris Anderson, the author of Free, The Future of a Radical Price, thinks the traditional music business is a bunch of whiners.
As you go through the process trying to figure out what the new model is, often the voices of the losers are heard most loudly because they're feeling it so profoundly, while the winners have not yet emerged.
But there are some winners emerging. They just aren't necessarily high profile. Take an artist like Jonathan Coltan. He writes songs about life as a programmer.
Code monkey, get up, get coffee. Code monkey, go to job. Code monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob.
On the internet, Coltan found the right audience for his music by giving his songs away.
Some people say, well, you know, it doesn't do you any good if everybody in the world is listening to your music, but they've all gotten it for free. And then I would say, I beg to differ. That's actually a fantastic situation. When you are not already a famous person, your real enemy is obscurity.
It certainly turned out that way for Coltan. Fans are voluntarily paying for his music. He's not rich, but he quit his day job. He says last year he made more money from his music than he ever did as a programmer. And Coltan feels he has more creative freedom than he would have if he'd signed with a record label.
When you're a nobody like me and you have this small, loyal, niche fan base, you can do essentially whatever you want. You can really be true to whatever quirky spirit moves you.
But music attorney Don Passman doesn't think this is a model that will work for all musicians. Some aren't as entrepreneurial. Part of the problem, says Passman, is that the technology hasn't reached a point where it can give people a complete online connection to their music.
And I could access it in my car, on my home stereo, on my computer, on my connected device, whether that's an iPod or a cell phone or some other kind of device, or even on an airplane. If I can get my music anytime I want, organized the way I want it, I don't mind paying for that.
But until they come up with something that consumers are willing to pay for, Passman says he can't figure out how the music industry is going to survive. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
It took a decade of planning and tens of billions of dollars, but U.S. television stations finally made the move to digital broadcasting 2 months ago. In addition to a sharper picture and better sound, broadcasters touted all the new free content that would be available on over-the-air TV. But as Joel Rose reports, the reality so far has fallen short.
Because of the digital transition, TV stations can now offer four or more different channels, where before they only had one. So if you're one of the 12 million or so Americans who only get their TV signals over the air, you've probably got some new options, like this.
Laugh at this.
Just what the doctor ordered.
An all-day marathon.
Thank you very much, Jack. Now I need to take two more Valium.
With movies this funny.
This TV is a syndicated network that mostly shows old MGM movies, many of which were forgotten for a reason. Some viewers can also get retro TV, featuring reruns of Knight Rider and Magnum PI. Two of the major networks are offering their own national weather channels. But FCC Commissioner Michael Copps says this is a far cry from what broadcasters could do with the new channels.
If this spectrum is going to be used just for home shopping channels and Doppler radar scopes and all of that, then it is falling far short of the purpose that it could be serving. And it has the capacity to really represent local issues, local politics, local music, local religious and cultural diversity.
It's also falling short of what broadcasters themselves promised. In the 1990s, they were eager to show Congress that they deserved to get their share of digital spectrum for free, just like they got their original analog spectrum free. So they promised a few things, like newscasts customized by neighborhood. Ellie Noam teaches economics at Columbia University.
Whenever a new media is starting, there's always the promise and the hope, really, of content that is local, that is educational, and what have you. And then kind of the reality sets in, and the reality are kind of cold economic facts, and they kind of tend to change the equation.
The cold economic facts are that broadcasters collectively spent $10 billion just switching over to digital TV, and content is expensive. Just one evening newscast can cost tens of thousands of dollars to produce. Local TV stations don't have as many viewers as they used to, and more than half of the viewers they do have are watching on cable. So they're not even seeing the new over-the-air channels, says Dennis Wharton of the National Association of Broadcasters.
There is a disincentive for broadcasters spending a tremendous amount of money, and let's not kid ourselves, it costs a lot of money to make compelling programming. If 60% of viewers are going to be denied access through the cable wire.
Denied access, says Wharton, because cable operators only carry one local channel per station. The FCC requires cable operators to carry local channels as part of their basic package. For years, broadcasters have been pushing to expand the so-called must-carry rule to cover their other digital channels before they invest millions of dollars in new content. But cable operators say they don't have room for the extra channels, especially for programming that doesn't exist yet. Brian Dietz is a spokesman for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association.
There's a definite capacity issue that cable operators are facing and don't have the unlimited ability to add broadcast channels that they don't even know what the content is.
But some stations are creating new services with no promise of cable carriage. Public television stations across the country have added additional channels devoted to educational and arts programming, although most of it isn't really new. One commercial broadcaster in California has found an innovative use for his extra airwaves. Gary Cocola owns about 30 low and full-power TV stations in California and Idaho. He's decided to rent airtime on his new digital channels for $5,000 a month. So far, he's had one taker, the Vietnamese broadcasting service based in Southern California. Cocola says he has other deals in the works.
One of the things that I've found is that there are many local people within the community that have never had the ability to have their own television channel. I believe that's really where the ideas have come from.
In a way, Cocola's business model looks back to a time when radio stations leased their least profitable airtime to super local broadcasters, who in turn sold their own ads to pay for it. Could it also be a sign of things to come on digital TV? FCC Commissioner Michael Copps would like to think so.
Now that we put American consumers through all of this trauma of getting right with the technology and getting converter boxes and new antennas and all of that, I mean, that wasn't easy for anybody. We've got the digital TV now. What are we going to do with it?
For now, the answer seems to be lots of weather channels and reruns of Knight Rider.
It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
If you were to pick up a pound of coffee at the store, you could reasonably expect it to weigh as much as it did last week or last year or 10 years ago. So you may be surprised to hear that it might not be the case. That's because the pound is defined against the metric system's unit of weight, the kilogram. And the kilogram may be changing. Jeff Brumfield reports.
This story starts with a metal cylinder about the size of a salt shaker. It was forged over 100 years ago in London. From there, it traveled to a suburb of Paris, where it was weighed, polished, and locked in a vault. And it's stayed there ever since. This little cylinder is the kilogram. I'll say it again, the kilogram. This is the one on which all other kilograms are based. That makes it very valuable.
I mean, I've picked up its container and I've looked at it, but I have not had the pleasure of actually handling it.
Richard Davis works at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, where the kilogram is kept. He's been in charge of the cylinder since 1993, but they won't actually let him weigh anything with it. And there's a good reason for that.
It can be affected by many things. It can get dirty. It needs to be cleaned. You need to watch out about scratching.
The scientists who keep watch are so paranoid that they've only taken it out three times, in 1889, 1946, and 1989. Each time, they used it to check a set of copies. In the beginning, the copies in the kilogram weighed the same. Today, that's no longer the case. Peter Morris with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He studied the measurements.
They don't have a lot of data, but it shows that they're drifting apart.
In other words, the weight of the official kilogram seems to be changing. No one really knows why. The cylinder might be absorbing air and getting heavier, or washing it before each use may have made it lighter. Or it could be that the copies are changing. There's just no way to tell.
It is the kilogram. There's nothing to compare it to. It is the standard. And so if it's changing, there's no way to know it.
The bottom line is that nobody is sure whether that cylinder in Paris, the official kilogram, weighs the same as it did 100 years ago. The entire metric system hangs in the balance. Well, sort of. The change is small, at most 50 micrograms. That's billionths of a kilogram.
The actual ramifications for a person going to the store and buying something will be negligible. But for very precise work, it makes a difference. And for scientific work, it makes a difference.
And because of this, scientists want to throw out the metal cylinder altogether and replace it with a reliable number that won't change. To get this number, they've got to weigh the kilogram in a completely different way. They've got to measure its mass without using another weight as a reference. And they've got to do it really carefully. So NIST has built a special scale. It's kept out back near the woods in a small building whose entryway is covered in little shreds of something black.
I have to apologize about the rubber on the floor. We have a raccoon that gets up into the rafters there and he pushes the stuff out the little cracks.
Rich Steiner is in charge of the scale, which is called a watt balance.
You mentioned about being far out. Yes, we're very far out. That we have probably more raccoons come out here than visitors.
Inside of a raccoon-free room is a two-story contraption. Instead of using weights, it uses electrical and magnetic forces to measure the mass of a metal cylinder, an official copy of the kilogram in Paris.
The fundamental part of this is actually fairly simple. It's basically a very highly calibrated bathroom scale.
Now here's how this thing is going to replace the cylinder with a fixed number. Once Rich Steiner can weigh the kilogram accurately enough, he'll be able to relate it to one of the so-called constants of nature, numbers that never change, like the speed of light. This will turn the kilogram into a number as permanent as the constants themselves. The challenge is that the cylinder must be weighed with atomic precision, and that's where the watt balance comes in. It's sensitive to as little as 10 billionths of a kilogram.
If you pulled a hair out of a person's head and then weighed them, we could tell the difference.
Unfortunately, a scale that sensitive is sensitive to a lot of other things, too. Vibrations from passing lawnmowers, for example, the tides, even earthquakes on the other side of the planet upset it, which is why it's taking so long to weigh the kilogram. Steiner's been at it for 16 years, and he considers himself a newcomer to the field.
It's just complicated, because we're making mechanical measurements, and we're doing it at a precision of 8 digits.
Despite all the problems, Steiner is confident that scientists will be able to redefine the kilogram in 5 or 6 more years. When that happens, the little cylinder in Paris will be replaced by a single number 8 digits long. Anybody with a watt balance and a lot of patience will be able to check it for themselves. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
And you can weigh Jeff's report against our other science coverage when you're checking our website and the other headlines throughout this day at npr.org.